House Committee on Land Use hereby convene. Today we have an informational meeting, and we're going to continue to look at the perspectives on the implementation of Measure 37. As you know, last week we looked at covering the counties from the standpoint of beginning to take a look at the claims and to move the claims along. And today we're going to continue that. We have two county commissioners and Judge Cooper from Cook County. And because one of our commissioners has to catch a 2 p.m. bus, I'm going to take chair privilege and ask him to come up first. It's a gentleman that I met 6 years ago when I was a county commissioner. I listened to him then and I listen to him now. Ben Boswell, please come forward. Yes.
With your indulgence, would it be appropriate for the three elected officials to come up as a panel?
Sure.
Thank you.
See, we're always open to suggestions, all right? So we'll have Tom Bryan from Washington County and Judge Scott Cooper from Cook County, who I've only always talked with on the telephone.
Nice to meet you.
And good afternoon, distinguished panels.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
That's includes you, Ben.
I knew I'd get our gun somehow.
Go ahead and start off.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ben Boswell, Wallowa County Commissioner. Mr. Chair, what I thought I'd do is just briefly go through our draft ordinance. I think that's a good way to address, bring up and address the issues that we've found with the implementation. I might preface that with just a comment that Wallowa County was the first county in the state of Oregon to have an acknowledged comprehensive land use plan, first county to go through periodic review twice, and we're still pretty, advocates of responsible land use planning, and so that's why we've approached this. Our policy statement is to responsibly implement the provisions of Bella Measure 37, balancing private property rights and public interest. We have a definition section, which is very similar to the administrative rule that the state adopted. In fact, we're presuming that many of our claims will be filed both with the county and with the state, and so we try to make our processes and our claim form especially as similar as possible. When it comes to submitting the claim, in our procedure, we're doing this realizing that it may not be binding upon the claimant, but we want a procedure that's binding on us so that the claimant has some certainty when they apply, when they make their claim to the county as to how it will be processed. And so, but this is the way we'd like to do it. And that is to have a sworn and notarized statement from the claimant that the information in the claim is correct. We believe that, and since the legislative record is a little thin on this piece of legislation, we have tried to use every bit that we can, which includes the explanatory statement, and there's a statement there that says the burden of proof basically is on the claimant to prove the loss in value. And so we think in order to do that, the claimant needs to submit the following information. And there again, we've included almost all the information that the state of Oregon has asked for in their administrative rule. Broken into ownership information, and we are still a little bit curious yet about what an interested owner, an owner that has a partial interest in property, whether that owner has controlling interest when it comes to submitting a claim. We need a description of the property. We need a description of the regulation that restricts the use of the property. We need some kind of a statement as to the change in value as a result of that restriction. We'd like them to tell us what kind of regulatory relief they might expect or accept. And finally, the evidence, which may include substances, title reports, and appraisals.
And do you have an indication on that for compensation? I mean, what they're asking for? Yes.
Compensation Code.
Yeah, we, Mr. Chair, we think that this is a 2 or 3 step process, and we think a determination on compensation needs to be made first prior to proceeding to consideration of regulatory relief.
In other words, you have to deny the compensation before you get to your other three choices.
Or accept compensation and move on to another choice. Yeah, that's not yet been. We'll work our way through those steps. We'll subject the claim to a 30-day review for completeness. The board staff will have up to 30 days to review and recommend to the board for a decision. We will attempt to meet with the claimant to discuss resolution of the claim prior to preparation of the report that is required to be submitted to the commissioners. And once again, we say the board staff may discuss and explore mutually agreeable means of reaching resolution of the claim, which could either be compensation or regulatory relief. We will notice and hold a public hearing prior to final decision. And we may, since we think the burden is on the claimant, and finding the information insufficient, deny the claim based on its insufficiency. We have put in a clause which we are not sure we can is intended, but that is the moment of time premise wherein the property owner is entitled to do all those things permitted by the regulations at the time of the enforcement of the action. That may include in reinstating some of the regulations that have been repealed since then. So we're trying to determine what that moment of time looks like, and so we've given ourselves permission to do that in this draft ordinance.
Representative Smith has a question.
I have a quick question while you were talking about that. Thank you very much. When you deny a claim because it's incomplete or they haven't satisfied, can they refile that claim or does that go into their 6 month?
As far as Chair Representative Smith, we don't think they have a single shot at the claim. No, they could refile at their pleasure.
Thank you.
We believe that regulatory relief is transferable because we think that that was the that's the purpose. If it's not transferable, there's no ability to recover the lost value through a sale of the property.
Commissioner, can I again? I hope you'll forgive all the interruptions.
Well, certainly.
But, what do you base that decision on?
Well, that is based on our what we have called the common sense approach to Measure 37,
okay.
and legal counsel's advice. Our counsel, as with most county councils, I think, has been studying this very closely, and these are some legal theories that have been included in our draft ordinance, and we think. We will decide on Wednesday whether we agree with that and are willing to include it in the ordinance. These are draft, and these are some issues that I think you're looking for in terms of what the state's role might be in clarifying some of these things.
Thank you.
We're going to give ourselves permission to extend 180 days with or without the claimant's approval. We want to coordinate with other jurisdictions, whether they be the state or a city or a service district. We're only going to require an appraisal if we decide on compensation. We are going to set up a compensation fund, which we can accept third-party contributions should that be the compensation be the preferred choice, and if there's money available for a compensation, it might be. We think that we need a stipulated agreement with the claimant as to what claim was actually resolved by either compensation or regulatory relief. And finally, if the claimant does not agree to that stipulation, that by the act of applying for or beginning that land use which was requested without the agreement is a de facto agreement. Finally, we've proposed a $200 claim review fee.
Any questions of Commissioner Boswell? Representative Smith.
Thank you. My question was, you said you could extend 180 days. You made that decision. Was that based upon so without the claimant's knowledge?
Common sense. Again, we think that it's in the claimant's best interest to file a claim that is supported by the evidence. But and it may take extending the review time to help the claimant do that. But at some point we need some closure to a claim that we either need to approve or deny.
Thank you.
Can I
represent agreement?
I'm intrigued with the common sense approach because I'm very much in favor of common sense. But there's also the law, mm-hmm. a set of questions, and if the rules of Measure 37 are either ambiguous or contradict common sense, you feel obligated as a public official to go with common sense as opposed to the words of the law?
Representative, if they're in conflict, we will go with the law. What it said, if it's clearly stated, we certainly will go with the language of Measure 37. But where there's discretion and the discretion is contradictory, I guess that's why we are chosen to make these decisions, lacking other guidance.
Can I follow up?
Uh-huh.
About the only thing I see in the law that's clear to me is that 180-day limit. Is that? That doesn't really seem very ambiguous. No, I'm not sure that either.
Let me read what the ordinance said. That was a summary statement that I made. Maybe I misread it or misinterpreted it. Staff may enter into agreements with the claimant to extend the time for a decision on a claim to a date after the expiration of...
Okay, I thought you said you were going with 180 days with or without the claimant's agreement.
We would like to have it. We want a completed claim for us to review, and so we will enter into negotiation for extension of that period of time based on the claimant's agreement.
I got you.
Representative Summer was next.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Boswell, I'm wondering where you came up with how you arrived at a $200 fee. Other counties are saying $500, $700, $900. Is $200 adequate for you to do the required work?
Representative Sumner, no, it's not. We chose a fee out of the air. We had arguments from everything from $0 to $2,000, trying to capture our costs, trying to make it a freebie. We finally settled on $200 as being a reasonable fee.
Thank you.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, the way I read this, that a part of the claim file must include an appraisal from the owner. Is that correct?
Representative Ackerman, the... are you looking at the state?
No, I'm looking at your
ordinance.
Oh, okay.
My pages are not numbered, so... but I have here, it says an appraisal made in accordance with these standards. And then you ask them to answer. So is that the Cook County representative?
Yeah, that's representative.
County, Montgomery County. Mr. Commissioner Boswell is from Wallawa. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm not. I'm in the wrong county and on the wrong page.
You're too far west.
Sorry, committee, though.
That particular item is at issue, and again, we will make a decision on Wednesday.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boswell, how many cases have you had, or applications have you had? And second point, how long would you estimate, or would your staff estimate it takes to investigate these average?
Representative Anderson, we have 3 filed so far, and we don't know how long it takes because we haven't started yet.
Okay. But you established a $200 just on common sense, essentially.
Should they choose to submit it?
Okay.
And Chair Gerard, just a brief review of the 3 claims, the type of things we have. They're very brief. They don't include the amount of information that we've asked for. And until we adopt our own procedure, we don't have any guidance to go by, which again is to use what we think is a very user-friendly process while protecting the interests of the people of Wallowa County.
Commissioner, if you had a wish list of action, either coming out of a state agency or this legislature, 3 things that you'd like to have fixed, what would they be? Or should I give you a little more time on that one?
Well, Chair Gerard, I would say the point in time, business about reapplying repealed regulations, transferability. Well, I would have to, I'm not sure the other one will occur to me as soon as I start home.
Well, let me know if you think of it anyway.
Okay, I will.
Thank you. Any further questions for Commissioner Boswell?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, just so I understood what you just said about transferability, I had heard you earlier say that you think that Measure 37 allows for transferability of the rights. So what would you like changed?
Representative Nolan, I'm not sure that's what I said. That's not what I meant. There are choices to be made, in our opinion, over transferability.
Okay.
And we're leaning towards agreeing with that transferability. But I can't cite you anything in the law that would lead us to that conclusion.
Okay.
And therein lies the problem. It's not clear.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
And excuse me, I'm going to have to duck out.
Well, I'll let you go. You got 10 minutes to catch that bus. Whichever one of you would like to go next, Terry.
Go ahead.
Commissioner Bryan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 53rd is better because the questions get asked of them instead of me. But my name is Tom Bryan. I'm chairman of the Washington County Board of Commissioners. And thank you for inviting our testimony today. As I understand it, you would like us to comment on the types of claims we've received, level of information submitted by the claimants, the process and procedures that we have adopted to respond to these claims, and also any problems or issues that we see that we feel are particularly important for the legislature to take up. Just to give you a quick sense of our environment up there, Washington County is just under 500,000 population. We are growing at the rate of 800 to 1,000 persons per month. 90% of our population lives within about 15% of our land mass. Ag and timber are still both critical key industries for us. And as you can imagine, with urban growth boundary issues, growth issues, we have a fairly steady rate of collision between these growth issues, preservation of farm and forest, protection of waterways, wetlands, significant habitat, and discussions emerging between the rural and urban economies and how we can accommodate both, especially at the edges. It's probably not surprising then that we will receive more, maybe 37 times than anyone else. We have about 60 to date. And our goal is to implement as fairly and efficiently as possible Measure 37. As of this week, we've had, as I said, about 60 claims, two within the urban growth boundary, and the rest in the rural area. By far, most of these, about 40, a little over 40, are on designated farmland, EFU and A20, AF20. We have about 7 on forest land, 1 on office commercial, 1 on central business district, and a few on exception land, AF5, AF10 exception land. So over 35 claimants are seeking almost two-thirds of these claimants are seeking 1 to 3 homes on rural land. Most of those are one home on a farm. Some are seeking up to 3 lots on a rural property. However, about the remaining third want to do more than 3, which means, by our definition, subdivision. So about a third want to do subdivisions of various sorts and sizes. Assuming the regulations are not applied, but appear to apply, this would add about 250 to 300 dwelling units in these rural areas, depending on the lot size that they ultimately come in with. Assuming that the regulations are upheld and compensation is paid, which frankly we do not intend to do, but if you chose to pay instead of waive, the cost of these applications is about $55 million. They range from a single claimant whose estimate might be $15,000 on up to hundreds of thousands, or actually millions. Most claims appear to be valid so far. Maybe 10 or less will be not valid. Most all rural claims appear that they will require a companion state claim, generally because of lot size or the income requirements. In some cases, specific goal requirements. Most claimants have little or no idea what specific regulation they need to have waived. Some have a general idea of what has prevented them from using their land as they would like, but cannot cite the regulations. Most claimants to date have not been represented by counsel, either a professional planner or a lawyer. And a lot of very individual home, kind of mom and pop, handwritten sometimes, or one sheet of type saying what they would like to do with their property. We've been accepting these over the last couple months. We haven't been in a rush to adopt a lot of rules and regulations because we basically hand everyone a letter saying thank you for this. We don't know what we're doing, and when we figure it out, we'll be back in touch. And we know that there are lots and lots of questions people are developing. We know there'll be most likely some kind of action from the legislature. We're sorting through these, so we didn't want to start staking claim, requiring things, but mainly letting them know that we expect to treat them fairly and efficiently, and that this is a work in progress right now. I think that's been pretty well received. We are handling claims. For example, not all claims will go to the governing body or the Board of Commissioners. We are, like with a lot of our land use, we try to have our department director make their professional judgments as we go. And so we have, for right now, said that our director will handle all claims involving 3 homes or less. no fee for processing a claim. Our approach to this is rather than creating an impediment or spending a lot of time tracking how many hours we will do, and will be so different in each case. Verifying age of ownership or type or date of ownership could be fairly extensive in some cases. And once you identify that date of ownership, you could almost, if you could run a line across and look at this whole continuum of rules, laws, regulations, and you could see which ones still apply and which ones do not apply, or at least are eligible for waiver. It's a pretty extensive effort. You could get into valuation issues, appraisals. You could get into, you might determine that an area is in need of special protections for environmental reasons or whatever, and have staff time involved in evaluating that. So rather than try to just throw a dart at the board, we have said that there are no fees for processing a claim. We'll treat this like we do the rest of our land use and transportation permits, in that what we do is every year we estimate the number of applications we're going to get for various activities. We identify how much time they're going to take on average, knowing some take more, some take less. We price that, do the math, and that's how much each permit will cost. And we work that out with the home building industry and so forth, and it's worked because the whole idea of claim recovery is supposed to be driven by cost. So we'll, again, try to estimate, and it'll get pretty loose the first time. We'll try to estimate the volume we expect, what kinds of costs are going to be involved, do the math, and we'll apply that as a surcharge to the building permit when they come in. So if they're just looking, wondering, we're not going to be charging them anything. If they end up coming in for a house permit or whatever other permit, it's priced into the application at that time, because we'll have a file on that. We're going to encourage claimants to concurrently process the claim and development application. There's this issue that do they have a claim if they haven't been denied their use? In Marin County, by the way, has done something pretty interesting here that we're looking at. It was sort of an administrative denial. If you know by their one sheet of paper that it's not going to be permitted under pre-37 law, we may be able to issue an administrative denial, then they can apply for the waiver. But we're not even sure if there's anything to waive until they've been denied. They may apply for something, that's okay, or it falls under conditional use or other things. So that determination has to be made, and we're saying we're going to try to find ways to make that concurrent so that we're not running people through two processes. I guess some of the questions, and I could go on a lot. We have our ordinance is in draft form. We have a work session on it tomorrow, in fact. And as luck would have it, Dan Olson, who's our legal counsel for the county, is here today. He's in your attorney's panel. So Dan and the other attorneys who've been looking at this since November have probably literally pages of questions and scenarios. Some of the issues that have occurred to us, Ben mentioned one of them about do these approvals run with the land? If a farmer does adds two lots to his farm and even builds a home and then sells one, does that pass to a person who would not have otherwise qualified straight out, or does it have a conditional use? So if it burns down, it's a non-conforming use. So if it burns down, it can't be replaced. Or, as I think at least one jurisdiction in the state, if not more, has said, no, when it sells, you bulldoze it. Of course, that's very extreme. And our question is, does it run with the land? Is it straight out? So someone could develop, say they have 500 acres, they develop it into 252-acre lots, and then they can just go sell them, and whoever buys them is okay. Or are there conditional uses or anything like that? Liability to third parties does concern us a lot, because two of the large, big issues up in our area is aggregate. It's very difficult to find
rock for growth. So aggregate rock quarries, for example, or on the other hand, waste disposal, solid waste landfills. What if a property owner is qualified on a farm near Highway 26 because they've owned it for 100 years to put a gravel quarry in or a landfill in? Do the neighbors, this is a third-party liability, if we waive, and because we can't afford to buy or to enforce the regulation, we waive. Well, what happens if somebody has 20 acres inside the UGB with neighbors? Same, and the same question. What happens to that? Is there a third-party liability, and whose liability is it? It's unclear to us, for example, we know that federal provisions like Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act are not affected or by Measure 37. However, our locally adopted regulations implementing the Clean Water Act or Endangered Species Act, as much as science-based as we try to make those, there's also judgment calls on those. So to the extent that we protect property, prohibit development on certain parcels, are there gray areas here where on one hand we are implementing federal law, but elements of it are discretionary. And so can there be claims in that gray area? Sewer and water isn't mentioned in 37. So if someone gets a use approved, but there's no requirement that a city or a county provide sewer water. And to what extent can a city or a county be compelled, if any, and we don't think they can be, to provide sewer and water? So you waive the land use, but they don't have sewer or water. When does that become just obstructionist? If you have sewer water across the street and it's not that big of a problem to have them pay to run it across. Or on the other hand, let's say you have, as we do, we have a strategic basin plan for drainage and sewer collection and water distribution. We have basin plans that are very sophisticated based upon future growth, where it's going to be. If someone comes in off the map, outside of the plan, adding volume to calculated capacities of these lines, can we say no? So there are lots and lots of questions, and a lot of people are better suited than I to share those with you and discuss those with you. I guess the one thing we would encourage to the greatest extent that cities and counties can stand it would be standardization. So the property owners, the taxpayers, and local governments to not have 36 definitions, 36 procedures. When I'm saying 36, that's only counties. In the courts, we have, I can't remember exactly how many cities, 240 cities. A long time since there was one of the mayors meeting there. But, this idea of trying to help get the definitions right, some of the basic procedures, the guidelines that would help cities and counties. One of the basic principles of taxation is uniformity. And I think we're getting into the area here where it's not taxation, but it's land use, property rights, where, again, uniformity would be good for all. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions?
I do have one, sir.
Representative Summer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Bryan, you mentioned earlier that you had identified an estimated $55 million in compensable claims. Has anyone done any research at all or made any estimates about how the county tax base will be enhanced if these Measure 37 are approved?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sumner, we have not done that calculation. That number comes from when people have brought in their claims. One of the questions we ask them as a preliminary question is their view of lost value, and that's the sum of that. But right now, we do not see, we just don't see Washington County being able to purchase properties or pay the claim.
I agree.
And are far more likely to try to work with their owners to achieve their aspirations in a way that causes least concern to the public interests. A lot of these folks have, because they don't know exactly what all they need waived, they just want to build their home. They don't even realize that there's actually 20, 30 things. We'll do pre-application conferences, and one of the issues is we can do pre-application conferences and inform them of all the rules and regs that they'll need waived. However, we also don't want to be their legal counsel.
Right.
Because if we add one that wasn't required or fail to mention one that was, then there we are. So it gets very difficult there. We've not done the calculation on what it would cost to, you know, have a levy or something that would take care of those claims. Might also add, like I'm sure a lot of you have heard, I think there's a lot of claims pending out there that might come in after they know what the rules are, after the legislature has acted and they're signing die. So they feel that they know what the rules are, they may come in then. Or maybe they want to, some of the most noticeable ones may want to come in after you're out of town, so you don't somehow prohibit them. I think we will see some developments, fairly major ones in forest land, you know, resort-type options. We don't know. We just don't know what's going to go on yet.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple questions on transferability and also liability. I'm not quite sure the liability problem that you were talking about, but I'd like compendium of the commissioners in your county. What is your feeling in terms of what the people were saying about transferability?
Interesting. Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, your first question was about third-party liability. By that I mean that we may receive a claim and we waive the rules and regs, and so someone does a land use, and you're the neighbor.
Like Hood River.
That would be one example. It could be in town, I have 10 acres, and I want to put some obnoxious use on it, and I've owned it for a long time, and I build it, and you're the neighbor. And you come into the county and say, why did you let them do that? That's the third-party liability, and if there's actual damage to neighboring value.
I just wasn't clear on what you were saying.
Right. The other question was,
your feeling or your commissioner's...
I've kind of been out there to see the local government or state or local again for 27 years, and after every election, people are trying to figure out what people meant, and it kind of depends on your point of view. If it was your way, you'll say that was what they meant, and others will say, well, that's not what they meant. They only wanted this. I don't know that there's a real way of telling what people meant. This is a measure that did we see others look for example, was there adequate public discussion? And I think there was a lot of discussion on this. Did both sides have enough money, if there was a campaign going on, to express their points? And I think, again, that was true in this case. And then what was the vote result? Was it 50.149? In this case, 61.49, they went. So whatever they said it strongly. I think people were looking for property rights. I mean, I think a reasonableness in our files. I think a lot of people, and it certainly looks like it in the claims, were very upset with this idea. If someone has a farm, that they can't have a second home on the farm for one of their children who want to help operate the farm. That has, is the kind of thing that gets to people. Others that, well, maybe someone has purchased 10 or 15, 20 acres a long time ago as an investment. That's their nest egg. They pay the taxes on it. And then when they were elderly and getting ready to do something, they find out that it doesn't have any investment value. I think those things got out there, and people were responding maybe to that type of thing. But I'm really speculating. You know, I don't think anyone did a scientific post-election survey on that.
One question. You mentioned also on sewer and waste, and if I understood correctly, you said that only two of the applications were in inside the UGB.
Right.
Couldn't that be handled pretty well with the existing DEQ regulations or with some of the step systems that would be workable for properties that are going to be split more than three?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, in our urban growth boundary, some of our urban growth boundary is 3 or 4 miles from the nearest city limits. And you know, Washington County is a bit unique, and we have about 190,000 people outside of city limits in that urban growth boundary. If that was incorporated, it would be Oregon's second largest city, and they're just unincorporated out there. So it tends to be patchwork, and you do have a lot of 10 and 20 acre parcels here and there. Some of those parcels might be a mile or two from sewer water. So we have the question of either they could do their own perk tests and get a septic tank, or a well, or a community well. But if that doesn't work, depending on the proposed use, can they come to us and say, well, we'll pay for it, we just want you to run it out there. And sometimes that might be workable. Other times it may be contrary to the basin plan and bring a load onto the plan that affects capacity, which could then mean we have to do things that everyone helps pay for. And, you know, it's just kind of one of those questions out there, more of a curiosity. We haven't had an application that raises that issue yet. These farm applications, we assume if people want to do 2 or 3 acre parcels on their 50 acres, they're going to be looking to get septic tanks, community wells, and so forth.
Thank you.
Representative Greenlake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, sir.
Thanks for coming. Some of these requests to build a house on a farmland would make the value of the land as a residential place significantly more than the value of the land was for farm use, and that's one of the questions they're raising. And these same properties have had a deferment of property taxes based on the agricultural deferment for perhaps also all the time they've owned that. Is the expectation of the county that they'll, as a part of this process, repay the property taxes based on the residential value of the property as opposed to the agricultural value for back as long as they've owned it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenwood, the county has not taken a position on that. I think it's an emerging issue in that if someone adds a second home and the primary purpose with that second home is to continue agricultural activity, then I think it was a good case that would not trigger collection of the deferment. Depending if you have 500 acres, 800 acres, you have one home and it's someone who's going to be working the farm, I'm sure they would argue that that should not trigger anything. On the other hand, we definitely have some applications coming that are, you know, maybe on 120 acres and they want to do 50 homes. Now, non-ag use would require them to catch up the previous, I believe it's 6 years, 7 years. Just like if they, any ag use that's had the deferment, if they engage in non-ag activity, that triggers that reimbursement. But the question, too, is if they've held it for 20 years, and the real claim is that they've held it for 20 years, and it's the fact that they've held it for 20 years that grandfathers them in to do this development, whereas their neighbor may not qualify. Then that question comes up, well, have you been held it for speculation? Not really ag use, and, you know, does it trigger collection all the way back, for example, not just 6 years, but through to their ownership? Because it's the length of their claim that's giving them this new position to develop.
Can I follow?
You follow?
Yeah, it seems to me that the common sense, we just heard some argument for common sense. I mean, the common sense would be if you're making a claim that goes back to 1975 and your ownership in 1975, then you are saying this was residential property from 1975, and that's the way you want it to be now. And it would seem to me, therefore, that residential value property taxes should be due from that same period, and I certainly hope.
If I recall the property tax rate, if you have a farm and you have a house on it, you are taxed at fair market rates for the 1 acre, for 1 acre on which your home rests. So we're paying residential value for that 1 acre with the home on it. We're paying deferral on the rest. And so if they added one other home, the question would be, if it's just one other home involved in farming activity, you know, is there some deferral to be caught up just on that second 1 acre piece? I don't know what the answer is, but I sure see a difference between that. You know, another common sense thing is, you know, the question of was the Supreme Court judge. I can't describe pornography, but I know it when I see it. There's a difference here when someone's adding a second home.
Actually, that's not quite what it was.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. But there's a difference here when you add a second home to a farm than when you subdivide it into 30, 40, you know, 2 acre or 5 acre homes, like probably. But honestly, we haven't gotten to that question. We're trying to drain the swamp.
Yes, does your process require an appraisal by the homeowner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, no. What we have property owners do initially, they bring in an address and a description of the property, a specific list of regulations that they allege to have reduced their fair market value, what they would like to do with the property, and what they feel their lost value is. At that point, we then make a decision as to whether what additional information is needed, who provides that information, the claimant or the county. If it's a foregone conclusion, we're not going to pay, then we would not engage in an appraisal, and we would not require one because we're just not going to get involved in that end of it. We just establish ownership, that they're eligible for waiver, for what are they eligible for waiver, and then waive.
Well, thank you. Commissioner, I'd like to ask you the same question I asked Commissioner Boswell. If you had your three priority issues that you would need solved or a direction given, what would they be?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that opportunity. And again, I want to underscore that Dan Olson, our legal counsel, may identify things that are more significant and truly more problematic than what I would think of.
Being a former county commissioner, I always know where legal counsel sits. It's right next to you, usually.
Thank you, sir. But I think the liability to third parties, at least I'm speaking for our area, because of how many neighbors we have to almost everything, the liability to third parties and the control of that issue, I think, is important. I think standardization, like the definitions, the ambiguities, you know, you can't write a major like 37 or any other significant major without, you can't write a book. So there are unanswered questions that I think everyone would agree are unanswered questions. So bringing definition and clarification, you know, the legislative, I guess, interpretation and filling in the blanks, and doing that in a way that it's standardized as much as practicable on a statewide basis. So third-party liability, probably standardization. Those are the things that pop into mind. I know council will have others.
And my last question, this committee is seeing growing evidence, obviously, that there is a bottleneck developing. Would you as a county commissioner be happy to see things go through the court system, through your circuit court, et cetera?
not if we can avoid it. So, I think that, you mean on appeals or just you mean answering all these questions?
On appeal.
Well, I guess the question is where do appeals go? If they feel that they've been mishandled, you've got, LUBA, you might have other state authorities that are out there. I just generally think we always try to exhaust remedies like hearings officers. I know our circuit courts, I just met with a presiding judge, and they are so buried right now with criminal and civil matters to put on them what could be a volume of, if we handle it right, we won't have a volume of things, but some things are unavoidable. So, I don't know, I think our court system would resist, and there are criminal matters and substantial business civil matters that I would rather put the court's time to. So maybe a hearings officer approach. We use hearings officers a lot with pretty good results. And I don't really know enough to say LUBA either. I think, again, depending on the nature and frequency of these things, I would first turn to a hearings officer format. Those have worked very well on a lot of contentious issues for us. If a party is not happy with what the hearings officer determines and his or her findings, that goes to LUBA directly, currently in our land use applications. That might be a model that works, again, depending on if this is something LUBA, I'm just not qualified to say this is something LUBA should be involved in or not. A lot of this is going to get into value. And
the reason I'm asking you is all kinds of rumors and bills that are rumors of bills that are flying around the building at the moment to address those type of issues. And so I appreciate you being candid in that respect. So thank you, Commissioner. And obviously we appreciate you being here. So
thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. Appreciate it.
Commissioner Cooper.
Shall we see how fast we can get through this to catch you up on your time? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Cooper. I am the county judge in Cook County. We in Cook County, Measure 37, received a 70% approval rating from our voters. We take that to be a fairly strong statement from our voters of support of whatever it was they were supporting, and decided we had better get on with the business of implementing it and not sit around talking about procedural roadblocks to it. So we were one of the first counties out of the block to get an ordinance out. We actually had an ordinance in place on December 2nd when people began to pick up applications. To date, we have actually had, we've had about 50 claim packets picked up. We've actually had 7 claims filed at this point. Those 7 claims represent a total of 899 new parcels in the county. 719 of those would come through a single individual who acquired his property in 1985, well past the date when land use laws were enacted, and his claim will probably go nowhere. So that takes us back to 180 new parcels, which, given the growth that we've experienced in our county, does not give us any cause for a great panic. All the claims that we have received at this point have dealt entirely with partitioning or with subdivision requests. Our claims process is relatively straightforward. We require the claimant to tell us where the property is, who owns it, why they believe the compensation is owed, what they believe is owed, and they must tell us what the enactment or enforcement is which diminishes the value of their property. We do require an appraisal, except in cases where ownership predates the creation of land use laws, in which case we waive that requirement. We do not require a fee. We require a deposit of $900. The deposit is refunded less cost after the hearing is completed, and costs are limited to paying the hearings officer, to photocopy charges, and to research which has been authorized in advance in writing by the claimant. Our claims are deemed filed upon receipt, regardless of whether you follow our procedures or not. So you can walk in with your cocktail napkin claiming you want your $1 million, and we will take it and thank you very much. However, we will not process it further unless you give us some information to back it up. We
We will put it in a file cabinet, and we will send you a letter, and we will tell you your claim is incomplete, and we will then await receipt of the rest of the information, because we think it's a pretty well-established principle of law that you have to at least provide the basic information to back up whatever it is you're saying before you can really expect anybody to do anything with it. We realize there is a little bit of risk in that, and if there's an area we would like to see clarified out of this session of the legislature, we would very much like to see that one attacked. Once a claim has been filed, it is reviewed by the Office of County Council for completeness. A claimant who submits an incomplete claim is notified in writing of the deficiencies and given the opportunity to correct it. Once the claim is complete, a hearing date is set. Adjacent property owners are notified, and a public notice is published in the newspaper of record, letting people know the details of that hearing. Hearings occur before hearings officers. We have hired a panel of local attorneys. We rotate the assignment of claims among them, and the procedure at the hearing is fairly straightforward. The claimant presents his case, the planning director gives his case, and we offer, accept any public testimony there is, and then the claimant gets the final word. After that, the hearings officer steps back and retires and writes up his decision and sends it forward. It is not our policy to grant compensation. It is our policy to waive if someone is entitled to compensation. In lieu of compensation, we will waive. So they get some notice that they will, whatever it is that has been waived, of course that's tied to whatever it is they asked to be waived. We do have a fallback procedure in that any member of the county court or the county court as a body can call up a hearings officer's decision and review it and request it to be placed on the court agenda for our review. That's our fallback in case of grave error on the part of a hearings officer that, say, granted $10 million in compensation that we don't have. And then after that, assuming that there is no review or whatever it is that the county court does, it is recorded and placed in the deed records of the county attached to that property. The final decision obviously can be appealed to the circuit court. In our ordinance, we provided that the review by the circuit court would be a writ of review rather than a second bite at the apple approach. A waiver does not entitle the claimant to proceed with development plans. A waiver only entitles the applicant to go forward with a development application with the offending enactment or enforcement waived as a condition of approval. Along those lines, we encourage people to come in and talk to us in advance of filing their claim so that we can get all of their various questions as far as what they eventually intend to do with that property answered in this one hearing. Obviously, there's a multitude of things, depending on what you're thinking about doing, that you might need to get waived at any given time or that might come into play. The more complete we can get that, the better off we think all parties are going to be. That's one of the reasons we do not require any upfront payment to come in and consult with our staff under Measure 37 claim. We'll spend a lot of time with you discussing it, and we don't require any fee for you to come in and get our opinion of what you can and cannot do. The other remarkable thing about Measure 37 is that there has been a wholesale change in attitude on the part of planning staff who once perhaps reflexively denied things in order to get on to the next project and now are perhaps a little more thoughtful about how you might get to actually authorizing something. The initial response to our Measure 37 ordinance has been predictable. All potential claimants who have talked to us are seeking restoration of the right to use their property. They are not asking for compensation. Most of the people that have come in to talk to us are under the impression that land use in Oregon has been repealed altogether. We work through the explanation of why that is not so, and most of them do not return. Those that have come in and that have proceeded with the process, two of them have actually gone to the trouble of going through the whole process, filling out the forms, submitting appraisals, submitting paperwork, paying the fees and or the deposits, and we are waiting on their hearings, the first of which will occur in late March. There are a couple others which we're still waiting for more information to come in. We have indications that those will be coming, and we have two who, through their attorney, have advised us they will follow no procedure whatsoever. They do not have to follow procedure, and they will see us in court in 180 days. In the interim, we have taken another unusual and notable step that I called to your attention, and I passed around copies of the document for your attention. We filed a lawsuit against ourselves in court on Friday. We did this under ORS 33.710. That is a provision that was added to Oregon statute, I believe, by Senator presented in minutes in the last session. It allows us to proceed to the circuit court and seek an opinion as to the legality, regularity, and correctness of a local ordinance. And we have asked our circuit to make that determination of exactly what we can and cannot do within the context of the ordinance and the measure. We do that both because we don't really know what you're going to get around to doing or not be able to do out of this body, and also because we would just assume that if test cases are going to be filed out there, they will be filed in somebody else's county and not ours. Should the court rule against us and take the position that local governments have no power to impose procedures, we would likely repeal our ordinance in its entirety and begin giving claims the most cursory of attention followed by approvals. Such a decision would be disastrous would bring about the disaster that many people predicted in the wake of Measure 37's passage. We certainly don't want to go there. We believe that Measure 37 can be implemented in a reasonable and fair way to protect private property and to restore rights to owners who have legitimately been denied them. It would be helpful at this point if the legislature would give us guidance in not three but six areas, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chairman. An amendment specifying in the spirit of Senate Bill 100 that local governments have the authority to establish by ordinance reasonable procedures by which claimants must follow to pursue their claims. An amendment specifying a uniform methodology for determining loss of value and what constitutes fair compensation. We don't know that an appraisal is necessarily the best way to get there. We just know that some definitive proof that you lost value is the precursor to filing your claim. So how do you get there, and how do you get there reliably? We're not particularly partial to a method, but we'd like to know what that method should be and see that adopted statewide. An amendment addressing the transferability of waivers granted under Measure 37 to subsequent purchasers. We have the same problem everybody else is. We just don't know. Our ordinance specifically authorizes the transfer of the waiver with the land. We have done that based on the theory that that which is not prohibited is allowed. And the safest course for us at this point is to allow it. If the legislature by statute wishes to take that away, that would certainly be the legislature's prerogative. But something needs to be clarified in that area. An amendment addressing the issue of whether partitioning and subdivision constituted use under Measure 37. There has been a great academic debate that partitioning and subdivision are uses. They are simply actions. I don't know. Nobody out here knows. You certainly can decide what that is, and it would be helpful to all of our claimants if you would let us know that as soon as possible. An amendment addressing the role of the circuit courts in hearing appeals. It seems somewhat pointless to do the two bites at the apple approach, go through our process, and then if you don't like the outcome, go up and do it all over again. And that's why we are proposing that it should be a writ of review to make sure that we use a reasonable process, and as long as we did, we should have some certainty of being able to proceed under that scenario. And then I think the last thing would be some flexibility for local jurisdictions, because we don't all fit in the same box. The attempt to fit land use into the same box is part of what got us here with this measure. So give us the opportunity at the local level to adopt those ordinances that make sense to our voters, that work for those voters, and that work for our unique and special circumstances, and then move forward dealing effectively face-to-face with our constituents. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Judge, questions? Representative Wayne.
Yeah, I'm a landowner in Cook County. I have 160 acres.
Why I get a letter from you?
In the south shore of the Pine Bluff Reservoir and Recreation Reserve. Can I just send you a napkin that says, I purchased this land in 1970. I'd like to be able to sell it based on the land laws that were in place in 1970 and ask you to waive anything that's happened since then?
You may send me that letter, and the council will send you the letter telling you your application is incomplete, but it has been deemed filed.
Inside the suit.
We have your claim, and we will then
that
put it
in. That protects 180 days.
Okay. And then you can proceed to the 181st day. We are required to recognize that the claim is filed, regardless of whether any procedures are followed. So it will be recognized.
Any other questions of Judge Cooper?
Anybody else with land in Cook County?
Judge, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Commissioner, thank you very much.
Let's put our next panel and bring up our planning directors, Michael Benedict from Hood River County and Keith Kubik from Douglas County. And then we'll bring legal counsel up in the last panel.
Thank you.
afternoon, gentlemen, and welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Michael Benedict. I'm the planning director for Hood River County. And I am here with permission in my county commission to make sure that's clearly understood. Hood River County did not pass an ordinance. They passed a resolution, a Measure 37 resolution, prior to the effective date of Measure 37. So we had that ready to go from the get-go. Our resolution requires a $250 fee. We didn't exactly pull that out of the air. There was quite a bit of discussion. We did a cost analysis, and we felt that an average claim would cost us about $2,100 to process. However, we wanted to make sure that we wanted to encourage folks to go through the process, so we set a fee at $250, which we thought was more than reasonable. We do not require an appraisal. We do require a title report or something similar. There's a less formal document that a title company will give you at much, much less cost, but they just don't insure it. We do not require public hearings, but reserve the right to do so. Our process, first, we make a decision on validity of the claim. For instance, if someone acquired their land last year and they're making a Measure 37 claim, we look at it and we decide it's invalid. Those will be handled at the county administrator level. Any claims that are valid will go to the county commission for a decision, not at public hearing. We do not intend to pay compensation, or I should say we have no funds to pay compensation. We will allow third-party compensation. Neighbors can raise the capital necessary to buy out somebody's claim. We have a process for that. We also issue a ministerial denial if someone comes in for the enforcement issue. If someone comes in and says, I want to build a PUD on my 2 acres of high-value farmland, then I will simply write them a letter saying, this is not a land use decision. However, the ordinance is clear that you cannot do this, and that will satisfy our application to show that the ordinance has been enforced. The first thing that we did as a staff is approach our commission and a public hearing and say, what's our approach? What's your philosophy and how do we implement it? And in our county, it's the people have spoken. It was much narrower victory in Hood River County than many other counties. However, we provide full customer service, but we do not help folks fill out claim forms because that's been deemed to be legal advice, which we're not allowed to give at the counter. We have taken all our ordinances that we have on file since 1963 and placed them in binders chronologically and placed them in the library so that I can minimize the amount of staff time with folks that really utilize those, and also it gives the citizens more time to look up and help fill out their claims. Our claim requires essentially the same thing that the commissioners had talked about earlier. The basic data that we need to do due diligence to make a decision. We also provide copies of the state form at our counter and strongly suggest that folks that make a claim with us also file with the state. We have not got to the point where we know what will happen if we waive something and the state does not and someone comes in with a development permit application. To date, we have 8 claims that total approximately $79 million. The highest claim is for $38 million. It looks to be a valid claim. It's on high-value farmland, and it's for a quarter-acre subdivision of, I think, approximately 200-some acres. All our claims so far are for partitions or subdivisions. We have received 2 claims from the National Scenic Area, which is a whole new another issue in itself. I think that our decisions are how we proceed, and as we answer many of the questions that are unanswerable right now, will be strictly from a risk assessment standpoint. We do not wish to take any risk of paying any compensation. We do not wish to take very much risk of incurring any legal fees should we go to circuit court. For a small county, even the legal fees are a killer. Some of the major questions we have, of course, is transferability. We're not assuming that the claimant has the burden of proof. We're not sure of that. If we go to circuit court, rather than going through a process, we will probably have to assume that we have the burden of proof in order for our legal counsel to be able to basically speak to the county's position. We're not sure if we get all the way to circuit court and then we offer a waiver at that point, whether we're still required to pay legal fees. Have they won at that point? One of the commissioners touched on it is the federal laws, especially with endangered species, our Goal 5 actions. A number of the Goal 5 subsets, we have safe harbors. We think that's going to be, and many counties, especially in eastern Oregon, don't have the money to go through the analysis of parcel by parcel, so we go the safe harbor route. For example, 50 feet setback from riparian corridors. We don't know that that's going to be defensible at all in court. Have we complied with the minimum necessary? We don't know how we can say that when we took a safe harbor. If we go to, a claim goes to the county commissioners, we do provide notice to adjacent property owners in the same manner as we do with land use, using the footage and the time requirements, etc. The state also intends to do that. However, county planning commissioners received a phone call from DAS, at least I did last week, saying, could you please provide us those names? Especially in counties that don't have GIS, that's a tremendous amount of work for us to be able to provide those lists to the state with no compensation. We haven't decided what we're going to do yet. That was kind of rough and ready, but that's I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike, for coming down. I had a question, just a technical question. On the 8 claims that you've had, and you said you would advise them to apply to the state, too, do you know if they have?
I actually haven't checked the state's database yet. I think they have a couple.
So we're duplicating numbers, colleagues. The director of LCDC was here last week and said the state had received 64 claims. Could those be the same 8 that you're using?
I assume that everyone that filed with the state probably filed with the county as well, but I don't know that for a fact.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions? Were you completed, Mr. Fenn?
I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Call in Mr. Kubik.
Thank you very much. Keith Kubik from Douglas County. I'm the County Planning Director. Brought a packet for you on local observations about implementing Measure 37. You have a wealth of information you've already heard. I just want to highlight a couple of points, and I'll respond to questions, and you have this data packet. Hopefully that will be helpful over time. First of all, in Douglas County, the Board of County Commissioners said, Keith, and to our County Council, Paul Minor, Measure 37 is going to work here. Find a way to make sure it works. Number two, a high number of voters, actually the highest vote west of the Cascades for Measure 37 was in Douglas County. So we have an obvious message, not knowing what that message was, but to make Measure 37 work. Two other points. We have over a 30-year investment in Douglas County planning, as we do in Oregon planning, and the board said see if there's ways to protect the investment we have in local planning with implementing Measure 37. And then finally, the board said, clearly, Measure 37 decisions are not land use decisions. We don't want them to smell like, feel like, or look like land use decisions. And our first cut was making them look like that. But that was changed. Aside from that, if on the booklet that I gave you, at the bottom of the second page, I have a little graph, a little chart that shows three claim scenario situations. I'd just like to bring them to your attention because they focus on some of the issues I think you will hear about over and over and over again as you consider legislation. They show three claim scenarios. The first one is land use regulations were adopted prior to a family's purchase, and then some member of that family, remembering you know that that's very broadly defined, applies for a Measure 37 claim. There would be no valid claim in that case. In the second one, it would be a family purchases property, land use regulations are established, and then the claimant or current owner in the family purchases the property. A claim may be filed, but there may be no regulatory waiver eligibility because the regulations were adopted before the current owner acquired the property. A big misunderstanding in the public about that provision of the law. And then thirdly, family purchase, claimant purchases or acquires land use regulations, and that's a valid claim, and then local government has the choice to compensate or waive regulations. Also, as you know, the word waiver is not in the law. It's not, there are three terms. It's not apply, I'm trying to think what they are, but there's three different terms. The term waiver is not in the law. It's modify, remove, or not apply land use regulations. Modify, not apply, or remove. On the third page, I've listed a series about Measure 37 interpretive issues, and there's a range of things I'd like to point out for you, a couple of things you've asked questions about as it relates to our program that might be helpful. But before I do that, on the bottom of that page, there's a couple of things that we felt were really essential to making this work. Number one, we felt it was essential to have a Measure 37 procedure that acquired adequate information for us to make a decision. Absolutely important. Adequate information, even if someone gave us a napkin that we were talking about. Number two, that it would probably be strategic for us to have a bare-bones ordinance that didn't in itself make a lot of interpretations because, as I heard from the judge from Crook County, we didn't want to test cases of lawsuits against Douglas County. We wanted them against someone else in the state, not against us. And so ours is pretty much a bare-bones ordinance that's close to the state law. And then following that, I've included for you a copy of Douglas County's claim form, which has some similarity to the state claim form. What I will tell you is one of the biggest problems we're having with our claim form is the justification or the documentation of reduction in fair market value. Most of the appraisers in our community will not take one of these claims. Appraisers in southwestern Oregon are avoiding these claims, and what we are getting is CMA's comparative market analysis from realtors. The appraisers are really shying away from providing information based on our experience. And Douglas County, in its ordinance, did say an appraisal or other quality information that could be used to judge. But we do require the applicant, or the claimant, actually they're not applicants, the claimant, to provide us technical information. There are some highlights in there that I noted on the application form. Then following that is a copy of Douglas County's implementing ordinance. And like Crook County, Douglas County adopted its Measure 37 implementing ordinance on December 1st to be in place on December 2nd. At the public hearing before the Board of Commissioners, we had two pieces of public policy that were changed that was unexpected to me. But it was a public policy choice, so for my board it was a right choice. And that was, and lawful, may I say, to protect and defend them. We had a provision for notice. They said the law doesn't require notice. We're not going to provide this notice at this time. We'll rethink that. So in Douglas County, there's no Measure 37 claim filing notice. One of the reasons the board was apprehensive about that is because you give notice, you have an expectation of a process. If you hold a hearing, it's a hearing that's using the term a null set because there's no appeals. There's no provision to add conditions. There's no what can you do but accept information and ignore it. And my board said, that's not good public policy to accept information and ignore it, so we're not going to go into that process. In our case for Douglas County, that was a wise choice. The second one had to do with, and I think this is very important with regard to the ordinance provisions, another part that we did not adopt, and that was section 10.080, and that had to do with mitigating standards. And that had to do with, if you approved a Measure 37 claim, could you put some performance standards, siting standards, or other conditions that didn't limit use that might mitigate its impact on other property owners nearby? And we're going to come back and revisit that based on the type of claims that we receive. And I'll give you that information in just a moment. The Douglas County claims procedure does a couple of things that are slightly different. We have a claim filing. There's 9 items to have a successful claim. There's 4 things in the approval criteria. Those are highlighted on the ordinance with a little marginal note. We can take 4 actions: deny, investigate further, declare the claim valid, and modify, or declare the claim valid and compensate. The Board of Commissioners, Douglas County, says we have no revenues, no resources to pay claims. We will waive in all cases. I would expect under some policy, public policy situation, if the money came forward and half the county came forward and wanted compensation, that might happen. It is authorized under ordinance, but our practice will be waiver on all valid applications. The process is, again, the Board of Commissioners said we want to delegate this to someone. Only the Board can waive under the law. So they vested the authority with me to review and investigate claims, to make a determination on them. And after I make a final decision, to give them notice, and within 5 days they could call that decision up. Otherwise, the decision becomes final. We did not go to a hearings process. We did not go to a hearings officer process. We did not provide an appeal process. None of those are provided for in the law. And again, the Board didn't want these to look like or feel like land use decisions. They just ended up resting with the County Planning Department. Finally, the issue of dual claims is an interesting one. Dual claims with the state and dual claims with the county. It's the county, it's our county's position that if, in fact, you have land use regulations that are out of compliance or inconsistent with the state law, Oregon law provides that the statewide planning goals and statewide planning statutes apply directly to local government's decisions. So we believe we could grant a waiver. We cannot grant a land use until a state waiver is also granted, because the state law applies directly to our decision making. We believe that's the case. That's the opinion of our council on that issue. So dual claims, some in urban growth boundaries with cities and counties, and in forest and farm areas, clearly dual claims would be required almost every application. Claims information, fees. We do not charge an application fee. We have a $350 archival research fee, and if a client chooses to do that research on their own, there's no fee. The development community, when we held our hearing, said you're getting a deal if you're getting the research for $350, and didn't complain about that. But we do have a $350 archival receipt research fee that accompanies claims. We do a lot in counseling claimants. We have handed out 77 serious claim applications. We only have 3 back. Of the 3, 1 will be denied. It's a Department of Forestry and Douglas County claim in the Scottsburg area. It's not valid against Douglas County. It appears to be valid against the Department of Forestry. That will be denied by Douglas County probably this week. We have 2 other claims that are for minimum parcel size. It happens to be in a rural residential area, a Douglas County claim only, and those appear to be valid, and those are likely to be approved. We also found, of the 77 serious inquiries, only 3 claims so far. We have sent several back for a second and third round, and the people in our community are cooperating with us, because we have said, if you want to be successful, we want you to be successful, the Board wants you to be successful, then let's make this a sufficient application. We could get some hard-headed person that won't want to do that, and we'll deal with it. We also had several people, and I think it's been 6, that we've said, you know, you could file a Measure 37 claim, but we can be faster and simpler if you file a land use application. And they did, and we've gone through a land use process for 6 of the 77 people, and it's worked. We have just been able to demonstrate it's a better application to make. With regard to Douglas County, as I indicated, the appraisal issue has been very difficult for claimants. The claims, specifically, almost 60% of them are for resource divisions, farm and forest land divisions. There are people that are frustrated, upset, dissatisfied, and uncomfortable with our statewide minimum parcel sizes, and about 10% of them have been for dwellings, and that's farm and forest dwellings, and again, it's the process, or as others might say, the rigmarole, or as others might say, no, never mind on that, the requirements to document either a farm or non-farm dwelling were just too onerous, and so they just want their dwelling. Those probably aren't to worry too much. The 44 land divisions, we do see some very significant rural subdivisions, exclusive farm use zoning. Most of the people are looking 2, 5, 10 acre parcels, but when you have 400 acres and you want 5 acre parcels, it's a big impact on the community. We do see some of those coming in. A real solution, let me set aside, I would like to offer you my professional opinion as Keith Kibbe, planning director, native Oregonian, and someone who has grown up with Oregon's planning. As a matter of fact, I've been a planner in Oregon since 1971. And I have true ownership in our system. One of the reasons why we have Measure 37 is because we don't have dwellings by right on lawful parcels. If we had that 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 3 years ago, it is my professional opinion we would not have Measure 37. The second thing is we have an unyielding statewide minimum parcel size. Before we had that, we had greater flexibility at the local level. And in Douglas County, the minimum parcel size was greater than what's in state law. And in some areas, it was less. And that unyielding statewide minimum parcel size is the second significant reason why we have, I believe, Measure 37. And thirdly, is the difficulty we've experienced, and it's really been the evolution of our law, not what's in the written law, but how it's evolved through rules and court cases on taking exceptions or adding to an urban growth boundary. And that has added to the urban and rural frustration, which then gave credence to the rural land use issues or the resource land use issues. That was my personal opinion. Now, you did ask a question, Mr. Chairman, about the three top issues.
Yes.
And may I answer that?
Yes, please.
Actually, near the end of my booklet, there are six. It says priority consideration for legislative changes. The key issues related to possible legislative change should include the second, third, and last are the three key ones. I would ask you to consider all six. The key ones are waiver transferability.
We do not believe the law is
clear on that. Actually, we don't believe it's possible, and we believe there'll be a lot of legal manipulation to get around that. Each jurisdiction will have to come up with a way to figure out whether a property owner has perfected their waiver and deal with that, and they'll be potentially a single case to litigate, determine that's $100,000, and it's certainly a lot more efficient for you to try to address that than having even a single citizen try to litigate through the court process. The second one is the statute of limitation on claims, and that is that the Measure 37 says you have 2 years to file a claim from the enactment, adoption, or application, something like that, of a land use regulation. Arguably, we say that our land use laws were applied, enacted, and so forth when they were adopted. But arguably, you could say your property has been zoned EFU, and 20 years from that date you come in for your first building permit, and someone could say that is the first enactment or application of the code. That needs some clarification for local governments from our standpoint. Where's the end of this? Where do we have some certainty? And the third point that I would bring to your attention is the clarification of exemptions. I seriously ask you to look at all six of these, but I'm giving you my top three, Mr. Chairman. And that's a clarification on exemptions, and that's conditions not restricting use, design review, and platting requirements. And we are administering this law as if platting requirements, talking about subdivision and partitioning, establishing corners, requiring a lot big enough for a septic tank, those kinds of things, making sure that you have legal access and clear title before you sell property. We believe that's in the public interest, and we're administering this as if platting requirements are not limitations on lot size, but arguably they could be, and we would hope, really hope, that you could clarify that. The one other thing that I included in this packet is a list of questions that the Association of Oregon County Planning Directors, that Mike and I are both actively involved with. He's our past president. These are questions that we asked Wayne Shetterly about Measure 47. I just included them because they're probably the same questions you've been asking. I'm available to respond to questions, and if there's anything else.
I'm sorry. I represent the mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To clarify your issue that you've raised about the date of enactment or application, and you gave the example of someone, you said, I believe, that you would think, from your point of view, that the regulation was applied the moment it became effective, but that someone else might consider that it's not applied until they seek a permit.
Correct. And that's a flaw in this. And from a county standpoint, we would like it to be applied when it was adopted.
And if I might follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow.
Specifically, when you're talking about some of these properties, EFU, I think you mentioned some of them.
Yes.
Isn't there a property tax assessment that's applied to that land based, at least in part, on the zoning?
The exclusive farm use zoning is one of the few statutory zones. The uses permitted in exclusive farm use are specified in RS 215, and if you're not in compliance with RS 215, you're not a qualifying tax deferral zone. That's why, even though we co-adopt an EFU zone, a dual filing would be required with the state and county. Specifically, there were some other questions about EFU. Normally, you do not pay your tax penalty until the use is changed. So someone conceptually could divide 100 acres of EFU into 10 lots but not change the use and probably not pay their penalty. But their penalty will ultimately be assessed when the use changes. That's one of the questions that I know that was on the table. The other one was, I believe, my best recollection of law is that it's a 10-year penalty phase, or it's less than 10 years if you've only been in the deferral less than 10 years, but it's a 10-year maximum penalty.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Keith, I would ask you, how would you handle a land use application if the use is prohibited by both county ordinance and state law?
If we received a Measure 37 application, or
yes.
If we received a Measure 37 application and it was prohibited by both, we'd say we can't proceed further, or we deny. If then we had a land use application that was denied by both and we waived, and the applicant came in and said, I now want my building permit, we would say, we're of the opinion that you still have to get your state waiver before we can issue your building permit or approve your division.
We thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony.
Thank you.
And our final panel for this afternoon is legal counsel from Washington County, Dan Olson, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Mark Pilliard.
That's right.
Your legal counsel from Deschutes County. Gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for sticking around to hear us. It's probably on purpose, so the lawyers have to be quick. I'm trying to be. What I wanted to do is focus on some of the issues that we're dealing with in Washington County as we put together our ordinance, and also as we talk among lawyers, because to respond in many ways to the questions that have been raised about what could the legislature do if you chose to do so, and what kind of issues are the courts going to address?
And would you identify yourself, please?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm Dan Olson, County Counsel for Washington County.
Thank you.
The first one that I wanted to mention is really pretty basic, and that is, what is a demand or a claim? How do you meet the minimum requirements under the ordinance? And some of the things that I'm going to mention that we think need to be addressed are pretty technical, and some of them have policy implications, and some of them sort of overlap. The first one that we'd like to be able to do is we'd like to be able to require all the owners to sign the waiver request. And the reason I say that is we've had issues over the years in land use applications where we've had two brothers. One brother signs the land use application. He wants a dwelling, and the other doesn't. What do? Measure 37 doesn't address that issue, and I think arguably does not permit us to require all of the owners to sign the waiver request. The second is to be able to require the property owner, the claimant, to identify the regulations that they want waived. And this issue has been raised by other people who are testifying. It's difficult, I think, for the property owner to identify those, but if we don't require them to do it, it puts us in the position of effectively giving legal advice to them. And as is mentioned, we may tell them, well, you need to get these four waivers in order to do what you want to do, and we may get 3 months down the process and discover that we missed something, or we didn't understand what it was that they really wanted to do. So that, I think, is an important ability to have. We, in Washington County, we're providing a free pre-application conference for property owners. We're not charging a fee for Measure 37. But what we are trying to do is get people into the development review process in conjunction with their Measure 37 claim. And in that way, we probably have a better idea, a better ability jointly to work together to figure out what it is they really want to do and what kinds of regulations they really need to have waived. The third area in terms of what is a demand or claim is this enforcement issue that's been raised. It's not really clear. The measure, I think, is very clear. There has to have been an enforcement before you can file your claim. What is not clear is what does that mean. Most of the people, or many of the people who have filed the 60 claims in Washington County, have never asked for anything before from the county. They've never been denied. They've never been cited. So technically, there has been no enforcement. So do we tell those people, sorry, you can't file a claim, and until you try to do something, until you file a land use application, we're not really sure what to do.
Question, Representative Smith.
Yes.
Mr. Olson, I'm going to ask about that, where you're saying that the claimant has not ever been denied or received any. Are you talking about a written notice from a county that says they have made an application? Or, I mean, I know many people, many constituents of mine who go to the counter, they're not given anything in writing, and they go away. So does that constitute an enforcement or application? Or they've tried, they don't know the process. So I guess my question is, what constitutes what you're saying they haven't done?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, that may be sufficient. One of the things we're looking at is similar to what Marion County does, where you can come to the counter, have basically a pre-app with the staff, say, here's what I want to do, and in many cases it will be clear that what they want to do can't be done under existing law. And maybe we can issue them a letter that says, if you were to apply, you would be denied. And one of the problems with existing law is that it's almost certainly a land use decision, and so that letter could be appealed, for example, by the neighbors. So it's really one of the things that I think could be clarified through legislation or will be addressed by the courts. What really is enforcement? How far do you have to go to have to really trigger your claim?
Thank you.
Closely related on this issue of what is a demand or a claim is another topic that's been addressed by several of the speakers, and that is, what can the local government require the property owner to do, if anything, as part of the local process before going to court? And what we're seeing in Washington County and in some of the other counties that I've talked to, and this is, it's kind of an interesting, I don't know if, I can't say this is a matter of statistical analysis, but a lot of the people who are filing claims on their own, the individual property owner, are being reasonably cooperative. We don't require an appraisal, we don't require some of those things, but they are assisting us in trying to figure out where they're at, when they own the property, and so on. A lot of the ones that are not cooperating are the ones that are represented by counsel, and they're just submitting their letter that says, I'm so-and-so, here's the property, here's what I want, I want my waiver, I'm not providing you with any information beyond that, and I'll see you in 180 days if you don't give it to me. And I think part of that, quite frankly, is due to the fact that they're entitled to their attorney's fees if they go to court and we are not. So I think that we need to be able to, in some manner, address this local process issue. And I think there are three choices that I've identified. We could, as is done in other statutes, you could just require or permit local governments to adopt, quote, reasonable, unquote, standards. One of the cost issues with that is everybody has a different opinion about what's reasonable, and that may result in litigation. You could require and specify by state law exactly what procedures all local governments have to use. Of course, one of the issues there is the one-size-fits-all issue. To my way of thinking, one of the simplest things that could be done would be to just simply say that when you go to circuit court, that lawsuit that you file is on the record. You are limited to the information, both sides are limited to the information that was provided in the local process. That way, for example, if you have an ordinance that says you must submit an appraisal, and the property owner doesn't feel that they need to submit an appraisal because it's obvious that the regulation has limited their value, they don't submit one, and they take their chances in court, and probably they're going to win on that issue. Judges are going to require an appraisal. But in other instances where there are questions about when did you own the property and exactly what regulation was in place, requiring it to be on the record would force the property owner to make some decisions about what putting on their case in front of the local government body and give us the authority to make a reasoned decision. The issue of whether a fee can be charged or not, obviously, is one that's going to be litigated. One of the kind of technical things, but I think it's an important issue, is the measure doesn't say where you have to file your claim. And the proponents of a measure have likened this to a tort claim. And the measure doesn't say where you must file your claim. And the proponents have likened this to a tort claim. And one of the things the legislature did a few years ago was they reformed the tort law because what was happening was people would file their tort claims with the animal control department or with the road crew. And technically, under prior law, that was good enough. And under Measure 37, that's probably good enough. We would like something that says you must file your Measure 37 claim with the planning director or someone, so, because we are concerned about receiving stealth claims from some people. Some of the exceptions I think need clarifying. One that I think is would be very helpful for us is to clarify that floodplain ordinances are health and safety regulations. They are not mandated by federal law, so they don't fit under that. And we will litigate that issue if it's not clarified by the statute, by the legislature. Another important one is the ability to delegate from the governing body. As Chair Bryan mentioned, we would like our planning directors to be able to decide certain fairly simple requests. It's not at all clear under the measure whether you can delegate. The measure speaks only of the governing body. And I think it's very clear under the measure that if we do delegate, the decision on the waiver is a land use decision, because the measure only says a decision by a governing body is not a land use decision. So that would be something that we would like to see clarified. In terms of the lawsuit, there's an issue about when does the... It says that if you haven't been paid within 2 years of when your claim accrues, you're automatically allowed the use that you wanted to begin with, and I think you also get paid. It's not clear. You might get both. But the accrual tool is not defined. And in Washington County, it could easily take 2 years to get to court. So you may win before we even get to court. So we'd like to see that clarified. The status of the prior land use rules, if you do decide to waive, does that automatically mean that the prior rules that were in place when you bought your property, you must comply with? I think it does, but it's not clear under the measure. So, for example, if, and we have a lot of these, someone comes in and says, I can't meet the $80,000 test. And when I bought my property, the $20,000 test was in place. I think the measure says they have to be able to demonstrate that they could have met the $20,000 test. But we repealed that test, and so did the legislature. So that's going to be a significant legal issue, I think, that will get raised. We're not at all. We've taken a look at this issue. We think that we may be required under state law to go ahead and issue a building permit, even though the person does not have a waiver from the state yet. And that, I think, may put the property owner at risk that they get partway through building their house and they can't get a state waiver. So we would like to see that addressed. And then, of course, the big issue is the legal status of the waiver. But what is it that you actually get if you get a waiver? So that's kind of a laundry list. It's not the top three. It's probably a dozen items that we think are important to us and that will get addressed one way or the other, either through legislation or by the courts. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Olson? I think your testimony indicates again the fact that while we need a standardization in kind of a conforming the application, it still must be built with enough flexibility for local governments to function in a reasonable fashion.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's correct, and I think also for the property owners, because different types of waivers may need different kinds of procedures, and it may depend on the jurisdiction. Some don't have much impact. Some could have a significant impact.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Pilliard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Pilliard. I'm the legal counsel for Deschutes County. I've passed around a spreadsheet, which I hope will address a number of questions that I've heard you ask other witnesses this afternoon. This was initially prepared by the Deschutes County Planning Director to include only the type of zoning involved, the general location of the area in the county in which it was located, and the amount of the claim. And when I learned about the opportunity to appear, I asked the director to expand on the number of items in the spreadsheet to include the acreage, the number of lots that were requested, and certain elements of the process which we think that the measure requires, such as proof of ownership, some evidence of title, whether or not a land use regulation has been enforced or applied, and the like. You can go over that as you wish. I think that there are, you know, a few observations we can make. There's only been 17 claims. This is as of last week. It appears as though it's predominantly in EFU areas, zoning areas, and it's not an indication that an individual wishes to, for example, add another dwelling so they can continue their farm use. I think what we're seeing is that people want to realize some investment on their property. It could involve quite a number of additional units, and I think that the comments that have been presented earlier pretty much reflect the uncertainty that is created with this law. The county's position has been one of cooperation. We adopted an ordinance back on December 1st. We encourage people to sit down with our staff in advance of the application submittal or claim submittal. We have found, however, that the information that we're getting is far from complete. And unfortunately, given the time frame of 180 days before they can go to court, we're sort of left wondering just how much of the claim we can agree to while at the same time doing justice to what the claims process requires. I mean, our attitude is we will work with you. We will try to determine what facts we can from the county's own records. If you don't have that information, the process allows the staff to receive and evaluate an application, even if it's incomplete. But at the end of the day, the board is going to be asked to adopt an order which grants a waiver. And we think that for the defense, if you will, of that decision, for the property owner's benefit and the county's benefit, there needs to be some facts to support those conclusions. Given the fact that the local process is optional, there's no certainty. There's no certainty on the claimant's part. There's no certainty on the county's part. And yet, we're looking at an $18 million worth of claims. So there's definitely some angst over proceeding with making any kind of decision here in light of the uncertainty of the process. We think that we've added staff, we're prepared to sit down with people, work through the issues, and I think that Dan's comment about whether or not people are represented by counsel maybe is off-target. Certainly there's an advantage for the litigator if there's a chance that they can get attorney's fees by prevailing in circuit court. That has to offer some incentive for the litigation route. But I think most people, and I love the commissioner here who was here first, the common sense route is they just want to get through the process. They just want to see their property permitted to develop. And we think, and this is another comment I'll give Dan credit for, that as long as the counties or the local government has some idea, and the more specific the better, what it is the ultimate objective of this individual. Do you want the rural subdivision? How many units? Have you thought about how you're going to get water, sewer, streets, utilities? Are there other issues that have to be addressed? We think that they should probably, you know, not necessarily retain the attorney, but the land use consultant or the engineer. In other words, determine if in the front end whether your project is feasible. Dan referred to it as the development review process, and that's pretty similar. We want to be able to identify all of the regulations that are vulnerable under Measure 37 so that we can address them in a single proceeding and not have people come back serially and, oh, I missed that one. I better submit another claim. Talk about inefficiency. Talk about how our land use system is going to be divided for such decision making. I think we're just asking for more and more disasters. I could dwell on my top three, and I think that, frankly, you've had more than enough good suggestions on what the legislature could do. But let me add one point that perhaps has been overlooked in the discussion. Dan's talked about it, and I think a lot of people have recognized the fact that if this committee and if the legislature doesn't do something, then we're going to leave the decision-making to the courts. And that's true. We'll go through a series of litigation cases, and everyone has their issue that they'd like to see addressed. And, of course, it's piecemeal and inefficient. But I think a better question for the legislature, one that the courts cannot address, is the future of land use in the state. Certainly Measure 37 is an indication of where the public has become frustrated with the process or the extensive process that has developed. But I would say that as we move forward, it's only this body that's going to be able to give local governments and state agencies direction on future regulations. How will you enact any future regulation if the result is that somebody can just say, oh, Measure 37, I can avoid that one, I file a claim for a waiver, and I can ignore it? This turns the policy on land use regulations that we've had historically on its head. And I don't have the answer to that. It's frustrating for those of us who've been involved in the process for a long time, and as the planning director from Douglas County said, they're invested in it. I'm not invested in it so much as I'm curious. This body is responsible more than anyone else for creating policy. In large part because of an absence of that direction, we've had the voters speak to us. But we still have an opportunity to establish what is the future of land use regulation. Will it go away? Will it, you know, shrivel up and die? I don't, have any crystal ball, but
it really is for this legislature more than anyone else to decide how that's going to play out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're more than welcome. I'd just add that if it were up to the legislature, we had enough bills in the last session. If we had been able to secure a signature by the governor, you probably wouldn't have had Measure 37.
I'm aware of that.
That's a political statement that I couldn't make. So, Representative Smith.
I just had a point of clarification. Maybe the chair can answer it for me. I noticed from the claims that you, the 18 claims, the majority are EFU zoned. My question is, of the 61 million acres in Oregon, how much is the percentage of zoned EFU?
I think it's somewhere around 70%.
No, the forest land, I think it's 97%.
Taking developer land, in essence. I think it is somewhere, it's a very high number.
So proportionately, that's why it's not surprising the claims are there.
Well, and of course, in Deschutes County, a vast majority of our property is held by the state or federal government.
Right. But these are private claims. Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Just to throw out a scenario to you. You award a claim to an individual who just simply wants to build a house on EFU land, which is what it seems the majority of the claims are about at this point. And you go in, and they have to have, let's say, a sand septic system put onto that property. But there's a high water table. And so they don't qualify for the septic system. So therefore, they can't qualify to put the house there. Am I reading that properly, and that's exactly what would happen? They can't come back to you and say, well, that water table wasn't there in 1958.
If I could answer you.
Please.
I'll do my best. You'll notice on the spreadsheet near the bottom, claims 5 and 6 disapproved septic. This is in the Lapine area, which in Deschutes County is historically, and not, I dare say I can't say this for a fact, but I don't think it's because of development. It happens to be high groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
It's the lowland of the Deschutes River. And we believe that this septic was denied because the application for septic was submitted later in the season than when it appropriately should be measured. And our approach would be to contact these people and say, you know, you need to come back during the window in which we measure the groundwater level for purposes of determining whether you qualify for a septic or not. But it's an interesting or intriguing question as to whether or not, well, it wasn't high groundwater when I bought this property, but only because of some other factors that have come along. I guess my feeling would be, the measure does exempt out certain types of regulations, including sanitary regulations, and if they can't satisfy them, I would submit that they're not entitled to a residential permit.
Thank you. I appreciate that interpretation. Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, just to follow up on the chair's question, at a conference I attended, and appraiser spoke to a specific issue and basically said you can't get the infrastructure to the home. The waiver exists, upon which the waiver exists, there's no value loss.
Right.
Okay. So my follow-up on that is, it really seems it's essential in this process to have certified appraisers that take into account all of these features, and I worry about the jurisdictions that are not making that requirement. That's just a statement rather than a question.
Okay.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I do want to understand the spreadsheet in response to the chair's question, statement that most of these were building one house on a farm use. That's not true in Deschutes County. In Deschutes County, 16 out of the 18, or actually 16 out of the 17, sound like they were subdivisions, not just, I want to build a house on my land. Is that?
Mr. Chair. Representative Greenlee, that is correct. We're finding the vast majority of the claimants are interested in rural subdivisions, as distinguished from adding an additional lot for additional residential purposes and so forth. That's correct.
Chair stands corrected, Representative Greenlee.
Well, that's good. I want to make sure I embarrass my chair as much as possible.
Absolutely.
For my career right now.
And the chair holds no grudges whatsoever. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. We deeply appreciate it. Committee, we will meet Wednesday. We'll continue with our informational series, and at this point, we will not meet on Friday. Committee on Land Use is hereby adjourned.